how agriculture changed significantly when we had this big shift south. So if you could explain what happened.
In China, between the beginning of the Christian era and about 1000 AD, there was a huge shift in where people did agriculture and the kind of agriculture they did. It's not, of course, that people abandoned the north, where they'd grown dry-farmed wheat before, but that more and more people had moved to the south, large population centres grew up there, and those people were engaged no longer in growing wheat in dry fields, rather in the same way that Europeans had done it, but in growing rice in wet paddy fields.
Why was this such a revolution in China?
The move from dry wheat to wet rice farming was a move from a relatively low productivity agricultural economy to one which is much, much richer, and one too which worked in a different way. Whereas to improve the productivity of dry wheat farming, it's a good idea to have rather large estates so you can share things like oxen and machinery and so on. It turns out that the best way to run wet rice agriculture is to have really rather small units, family-sized farms, and on those farms, really, human skill is much more important than machinery and animal power. It's really a way, I suppose, of replacing hardware by software.
So that must have had quite a radical effect then in terms of development of craft skills and things and, you know, milling techniques, all that kind of thing. Can you expand on that?
Yes, very quickly. Another thing about the shift from dry wheat farming to wet rice agriculture is, of course, that if you're living in an economy where your main food is wheat, you won't find it very nice if you simply put the stuff in a pot and boil it. All you'll end up with is a kind of rather nasty porridge. To make it palatable, you need to go through a whole business of course, hulling it, yes. You have to do that with rice too. But then you have to grind the stuff up into flour and make bread out of it. Whereas the marvellous thing about rice is that once you've just got the husks off, you can boil the stuff or steam it, and it's instantly palatable. So there's a whole range of technology which is simply not required if you're doing wet rice. That is the technology of heavy milling of grain. You can make rice flour, but it's not the main thing that you do when you're going to eat rice.
So do you think this shift to rice agriculture could have been a contributing factor in the delay in the Industrial Revolution in China?
Some scholars feel that the technology of milling is very significant during the European Middle Ages as a preparation for the later machine culture of the Industrial Age. And it's certainly true that although there are many machines in China, they're concerned more with things like water raising, for instance, and using water power to do perhaps some other tasks other than milling. Certainly, the widespread use of milling is not there in the wet rice south.
But, I mean, other uses of wheels are very much apparent in China, so they could have been developed in other ways, possibly.
Yeah, and if you are into wet rice agriculture, you certainly need wheels in many other ways. You need them for machines to raise water out of your fields if you find you've got too much, or to raise water into your fields if you've got too little. And as well as that, of course, there are all kinds of other applications to which machinery of various kinds can be applied, such as, for instance, pounding mills for hulling rice. You do need to hull the rice, or even to prepare, materials for making ceramics. So I wouldn't say that medieval China, with its rich wet rice agriculture, was devoid of opportunities for making machines.
So why weren't more machines?
I don't know why the Industrial Revolution didn't happen in China. That's the problem. I'm unable to produce a nice factor that says, you know, sort of why, because I'm not sure the point is proved that medieval China is a sort of a less mechanical place than the medieval Europe. Well, there were certainly a lot of mills in medieval Europe.
Right.
If you want to know something about the level of technical development in the rich agricultural areas of medieval China, you can look, for instance, at a book published in the Yuan Dynasty under the Mongols in 1313, a Baoban called Wang Zhen. It's called Nongshu, which means the Book of Agriculture. is not only full of all kinds of advice on growing plants, but it's full of descriptions of machines of all kinds for doing useful jobs, using water power, animal power, and so on, mainly. But there's no sense there that you're dealing with a civilization that is just about dibbling about in the mud with hand tools. If you want machines, there are machines there to do it. So yet again, we find another example in China of something that certainly wasn't missing. There was no missing sense of an interest in machinery when it was useful to explain why an industrial revolution didn't later occur in China. It's something we will want to look into.
But you must have some sort of personal hunches or ideas. I mean, it seems to me you're not addressing this question. You refuse to. I know it's a negative question.
But they weren't as clever as us. No, I'm sorry, but
that's obviously not the explanation.
Exactly.
No.
I can't think of an explanation,
seriously. But surely it's got to be something more social and
I believe
political.
It to be essentially a question.
Sorry, could you start that again?
If you want to ask questions about why things didn't happen in China, I would say that all the answers to those questions turn out really to be answers to questions about what happened in Europe. So my basic view is that there is nothing about China that means that an industrial revolution could not have happened there. But once an industrial revolution has happened in one part of the world, it obliterates the possibilities for that happening again anywhere else. Which is why, ultimately, I feel that asking the question, why didn't it happen here, will lead you into some rather pointless ways of thinking, because ultimately you're asking a question about why something did happen somewhere else in Europe.
Yes, but obviously you're trying to, by looking at different countries, you're trying to tease out a set of circumstances that might have made Britain, for whatever reason, originally unique. So equally, when you think of the delays that occurred here, you have to start looking for some explanations.
One of the problems, again, about saying, well, what was it that was special about Europe that was the thing that made it have an industrial revolution, or particularly Britain made that have an industrial revolution? You end up sometimes, I think, kidding yourselves that you're getting explanations when all you're doing is describing. Because unfortunately, owing to the fact that we haven't yet made contact with any other planets with intelligent life on them to see how they developed high levels of technology in their equivalent of an industrial revolution, we have no parallel test cases to see what things really are necessary to have an industrial revolution. And indeed, the whole idea of having an industrial revolution maybe something that we have constructed purely because of the particularities of technical development in Britain and in other parts of the world. So I'm very wary of attempting to look in detail at particular places in particular times and say what was special about them and then make that into a cause. Because we can't do experiments with history. We can't take away those factors and then see what would have happened without them.
But there was a quite interesting experiment going on here because China was so isolated from the West, and therefore you've got two totally separate societies, each evolving, one with potentially much more promise than the other, i.e. China, and one that really was rather backward compared to China, and yet the opposite to what you expect happens. So that's, to me, the central question.
What the Chinese experience does teach you is that something like this. If you've got a large area of the world with a deep, deep heritage of culture and a high level of early technical achievement, it does not guarantee that by about 1800 you will have had an industrial revolution. And we don't know what would have happened after that because, as I said, the game is foreclosed by people in Europe having one instead.
But you surely get some clues when you look at the delay. It took even a further century. It's the time it took the Industrial Revolution to happen in China, say, compared to Japan. Surely that gives you clues as to what elements were missing here, or what kind of things politically or socially were going on which might have delayed it.
Good stuff. I don't think one can argue from the relatively slow response of Chinese society to developments in the West to argue that there was some kind of inertia about it. The fact is that China was culturally, politically and economically a great big supertanker sailing along the seas of history. And at first, quite frankly, the perturbations from outside were very small and peripheral, a matter of what seemed to the people in the great ship of a few little rocks bumping along the outside. It wasn't until they hit a great big reef, in the sense of finding in 1900 that eight Western armies arrive in their capital after the Boxer Rising, that the message was so very clear that people began to put the wheel on the bridge hard over. If you compare it with Japan, Japan is a much smaller society than China, with much less inertia in political and economic terms. And it's not surprising that the change there was more rapid, given also the fact that the samurai class in Japan saw very clearly, rather quickly, that it would be in their interest to change the system, to give up their privileges, to become ordinary citizens, but to have the right to trade and to become merchants and so on. It was not the case that those advantages were there for the scholar gentry class in China. So even when we look at their own self-interest, they would certainly did right to be cautious for a long time. So to sum it up, I would not say that the slowness of China to change its ways shows anything about the impossibility of China having ever done anything novel. China had done many novel things at many times in the past, but the forces that acted on it in the 19th century were at first relatively small and peripheral forces, and it would have been very odd indeed if Chinese emperors had suddenly said, oh, we've got to change everything, because I don't think that would have been a wise policy.
But that then surely is the explanation, isn't it?
Of what?
Of the delay. It was the emperor's central... Surely that's the crucial factor, isn't it? I think it's one of the main factors.
Oh, well, the emperor... Yeah, you can't blame the slow development of 19th century China on the emperor obstructing things, because the whole story of 19th century China is, in many ways, the collapse of central imperial power and the passing of initiative to the provinces. This was particularly marked after the Taiping Rebellion of 1850 to 1864, in which the Qing Dynasty only survived as a political entity and as a dynasty because the power was passed down to various provincial strongmen who could, unlike the central government, organise effective military forces, organise ways of raising revenue, and themselves went in, for instance, for such obvious westernisation as modern weapons for troops, modern military drill, and so on. So China had indeed, in the 19th century, gone a long way to break any central power grip of the emperors. And by the time that the 1911 revolution took place, I could say that imperial power was no longer really effective as a means of controlling the polity of the empire, whether to make things happen or to stop them. Westerners were so impressed with the necessity for water control in China, all the way down from flood control to irrigation, that during the 30s, some scholars convinced themselves that this explained the way China was governed, that there was a thing called Oriental despotism, which was made necessary, heavy centralized government, by the fact that there had to be central government control of waterworks everywhere. This has since then been pretty well exploded, because there are so many instances of societies with considerable amounts of waterworks and irrigation without that kind of centralized government. But it was certainly seen as being a possible explanation for why China was this huge centralized empire, as indeed it was.
This change in agriculture, this shift from north to south, and how it transformed China.
By 1000 AD, the center of the Chinese agricultural economy had moved down to the south and had turned over to wet rice production. Now, in the north, if you're planting a crop, you plough the field, you put in the seeds, using a seed drill, fine, and you cover it up again. And hopefully it may rain, you may be able to irrigate it. In the south, the technology is quite different, because where you're getting your grain from is the rice plant, and the rice plant is basically a highly adapted and selected marsh grass. It's designed to grow on the edge of lakes, for instance, or in swamps. And therefore, if you want to grow it, you've got to make an artificial swamp. The first thing you do is to make a very special, nice little swamp in which you plant the rice seeds. Then when the seedlings grow up, you transplant them into a flooded field, as this was until fairly recently. It's now down to mud here. And the rice plant grows at first in the flooded field. Now, what you do then is to mimic the conditions it's used to as the year advances and the swamp dries up a bit by letting the water out of the field until finally, when you harvest it, typically, in most cases, you've got yourself a dry field that you're harvesting it from. So very careful control of water levels is the name of the game here. If you make the water levels too low, then all kinds of other weeds will grow with the rice. If you make the water levels too high, then the rice stalk, to get itself out of the water, will grow too long, and eventually it will flop sideways and you won't be able to harvest the crop. But if you do all this just right, and if you weed and weed and weed and weed, of course, lots of work for human fingers here, then you'll end up with a very rich crop like this. It hasn't started yet to show its seed heads, but it will soon. And then this turns out to be one of the most productive ways human beings have ever been able to use land with. And one of the ways that is indeed, when well run, the most secure way indeed to get your living, because you only need a small fraction of the seed to be kept for next year, to plant next year's crops, compared to what you need if you're growing dry wheat.
Okay, very, very good.